Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Flu on the move, a crossover and an exit in Washington, and a bankruptcy in Detroit this week. Swine flu is now dubbed H1N1. Here's Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano.
It is very likely that we will see more serious presentations of illness and some deaths as we go through this flu cycle.
Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter switches parties. He is now a Democrat.
I have not represented the Republican Party. I have represented the people of Pennsylvania, and I will continue to do just that.
And Chrysler goes belly up briefly, says President Obama.
And that's why I'm supporting Chrysler's plans to use our bankruptcy laws to clear away its remaining obligations so the company can get back on its feet and onto a path of success.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Do you see Chrysler Fiat coming back strong? Arlen Specter lining up for Obama. Have H1N1 and Joe Biden scared you off the plane, the subway, out of your wits? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Margaret Taleb, White House correspondent from McClatchy Newspapers. Margaret, great to have you back with us.
Hello, Tom. Nice to be here.
Good to have you. Also from the nation's capital, Michael Gerson, columnist for The Washington Post. He was a White House advisor and speechwriter for President George W. Bush, author of Heroic Conservatism. Michael Gerson, great to have you as well.
Good to be with you again, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Margaret, and Michael.
Let's go straight to our vice president. I made too light with snakes on a plane, but Joe Biden was kind of out there on his own hook this week, talked with NBC's Today Show, Matt Lauer, off message here, giving with the advice that he would give to his family about what to do and not to do now.
I would tell members of my family, and I have, I wouldn't go anywhere in confined places now. It's not that it's going to Mexico. It's you're in a confined aircraft. When one person sneezes, it goes all the way through the aircraft. That's me.
Okay, snakes on a plane and no subway either, says the vice president, Margaret Taleb. I mean, this is not the message we're getting from the CDC. He's got us down in our bomb shelter bunkers here, practically. We're going nowhere. But what do you think about the way the vice president, but then the whole administration, is handling this big threat, apparently, so far?
Well, I think the vice president's problem was that he answered the question too honestly.
Yeah.
He was asked what he would tell his family. And I think when you're a public official, sometimes what you tell your family is really different from what you tell the rest of the country.
Nobody's going nowhere.
Don't you dare get on the subway.
Right.
It's made it easier for me. I take the subway to work every day. And there have been more seats
out
in the last couple of days.
Thank you, Joe.
I think the administration has struggled a little bit because the country is still understanding and public health experts are still understanding how big the threat really is. It seemed like early on they didn't want to overly minimize it, but people here really weren't dying of it or even getting sick that much. But now in the D.C. area, we see it's crept into Maryland. It's not a pandemic in the United States. I think the vice president was totally off message and probably should have had some caveats like, if you're sick or have a compromised immune system or you're very young. But he didn't say that. He just blurted out what he was thinking.
The caveats came later. They didn't exactly honestly portray what the vice president had said. But I think everybody's past that, Michael Gerson, and looking at, wondering what is the reality here. There's been, it seems to me, an attempt to keep the right balance between alarm and just sober attention. But, I mean, looking around the world here in New Zealand, they're not, Catholics aren't putting the communion wafers on worshipers' mouths anymore. The Maori there are not doing nose-to-nose greetings. And right on around the world, I mean, you've got school districts closed in Fort Worth. And what do you make of this, Michael?
Well, I actually saw someone at the ATM machine today who had latex gloves on. I think that is a little bit of an overreaction, too, maybe listening too much.
Wiping down the keypad before and after, that's the new the new protocol?
But the, you know, the reality here is that, you know, it is a global threat at a high level. There are, you know, cases reported in a variety of places.
All over.
There's very little you can do on the global level, you know, with international travel and other things. People talk about closing the border. These are not practical methods to control the disease in our modern world. It just doesn't work that way. And the paradox here is so much about the spread of the disease depends on local healthcare systems. Mm-hmm. Are they ready? We've put a lot of money into it after 9/11 for a variety of reasons. There were reports in the Washington Post this morning questioning whether some, like Maryland and D.C., whether they had enough Tamiflu and other treatments. And then it also depends on the individual, doing things like washing your hands and watching out if you're sick and not going to work and other things like that. So this is a global crisis that comes down to, is your local health care prepared, and are you taking responsible measures here? You know, right now the signs are that this may not be as virulent a strain as some people initially feared.
Let us
there
hope.
There have been deaths, but it doesn't look like it's going to take, you know, as many lives as was initially thought, although they don't know. But the problem with the flu, as we saw like in 1918, is in the worst flu epidemic in world history that killed tens of millions of people, the death rate was only about 2%. And the problem is that it spread so quickly, so widely, that the death rates can go quite high, even though individually your chance of dying is not high.
And Jack, these days we give everything a big assist. It is a small world after all. It's global. It's in a village in the sort of outback of Mexico, and the next thing you know, it's New Zealand, South Korea, Eastern Europe, Kansas. I mean, we go everywhere. We take everything biological with us, Jack.
We do indeed. You know, this is a good argument, really, for national health insurance when you think about it. The CDC recommends, quote, your health care provider will determine whether influenza testing or treatment is needed, end quote. Well, 45.7 million Americans don't have a health care provider, and they are a potential vector for a disease like this to take root. That's one point I would make about it. The second point, of course, is that there is another pandemic going on, and that is the paranoia pandemic among conservative talk radio. You have Michael Savage saying, make no mistake about it, illegal aliens are the carriers of the new strain. You've got the aptly named Neil Bortz saying, what better way to sneak a virus into this country than to give it to Mexicans, right? You've got someone named Jay Severin in Boston who's been fired for this, or at least suspended for blaming the swine flu on the, quote, world's lowest of primitives in poor Mexico. This kind of thing is going on.
I thought
on
it was an American hog factory farmer down
right
there that may be suspected.
Right.
It's not Mexican billionaires at the Tavern on the Green? Couldn't it
not
be? Couldn't it be?
Apparently not. And, you know, this sort of, you know, a political unconscious out there blaming the blaming Mexicans, this is an ugly aspect of the whole deal.
That border is that border has a lot of resonance on all sides. You mentioned health care, Jack, and moves in Washington this week that may affect the outcome there. Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, shifting from the Republican to the Democratic Party. He railed against, as he did it, the conservative Club for Growth. We're going to talk with their executive director right here along with Christy Todd Whitman on Monday. But here's Specter going through a litany of examples where moderate Republican lawmakers were destroyed in primary challenges by what he called the far right, costing Republicans control, he said, of the Senate and undermining what he wanted to see as the GOP agenda.
They don't make any bones about their willingness to lose the general election. If they can purify the party, I don't understand it, but that's what they say. And for the people who are Republicans, to sit by and allow them to continue to dominate the party after they beat Chafee, cost us Republican control of the Senate, and cost us 34 federal judges, there ought to be a rebellion. There ought to be an uprising.
Well, there's not. But one senator is voting with his feet. And there is a tussle. Here's Michael Steele, RNC chairman, kicking back at Specter. There's some background noise here in the CNN interview.
Senator Cornyn went out on the line for this man. And for the senator to effectively flip the bird back to Senator Cornyn and the Republican Senate leadership, hit the team that has stood by him, who went to the bat for him in 2004 to save his hide, to me is not only disrespectful, it's just downright rude. I'm sure his mama didn't raise him that way, and it's a shame that he's behaving this way today.
Did he give you a heads up on this?
No, not at all, which is another form of disrespect.
Michael Steele and the Republican Party dissed by Arlen Specter. Margaret Taleb, what about it? He says that he's flipped the bird to Senator Cornyn and the Republican leadership. How do you interpret what's just happened, Margaret?
I think what's just happened is a reflection of the shift in so many places, including especially in Pennsylvania, over a fairly quick period of time of registered Republicans into the Democratic and independent camps. And if you take away sort of some of the anger and frustration and drama over this, and if you take away the fact that there is an opportunistic angle, obviously, to what our Arlen Specter's doing, I think at the bottom of it, what he's saying is also true, that the party that he joined decades ago isn't really the same party that it is now. And he's always been, it's not like he was a hardcore conservative voter on, you know, a standard bearer on these issues. For years, Arlen Specter was sort of one of the Republicans you'd go to when you wanted to test the swing portion of the party. And so there's less swing in the Republican Party. And he saw the writing on the wall. And frankly, I think it's sort of not that big of a surprise. And the real question is whether there's any chance that the couple of remaining moderate Republicans will consider the same switch.
Michael, you know this party well. I want to get you after the break here on what you think it means. But Jack Beatty, briefly before the break, is this it? Does Obama have what he needs now? This plus a little Al Franken in there from Minnesota maybe, and whatever the Democrats want, the Democrats will get?
No. Votes on filibusters do not really track with party votes at all. I mean, that's a media construct, the 60 vote. If you look back at history, people have all sorts of reasons for voting on cloture.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a week in the news. Chrysler goes bankrupt. Suitor will retire. Specter swings Democrat and pandemic fever over H1N1, what we used to call swine flu. Michael Gerson is with us, columnist for The Washington Post, fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, speechwriter and policy advisor for President George W. Bush from 2001 to 2006, author of Heroic Conservatism. Margaret Taleb is here from Washington, White House correspondent and a darn good one from McClatchy Newspapers, while they last. Hope they last a long time for you, Margaret. Jack Beatty's here as well. Michael Gerson, you know the Republican Party very well. Give us your take on the Specter move.
Well, it arguably was one of George W. Bush's worst political mistakes to intervene decisively to save Arlen Specter in 2004.
He and Cornyn, as Michael Steele was saying.
Right, exactly. Weighed in heavily, and clearly that kind of move didn't make much difference in this case. You know, he can hardly complain of bad treatment on the part of the party when it saved him. But I would say that, you know, there are some Republicans that say, you know, that welcome this, that it's going to leave the party more pure. The reality is the goal of a party is to have as many representatives as you can. It's not helpful to lose any. And it's causing a lot of soul searching among Republicans, not just this, which was really in many cases just a rather cynical move, not an ideological one, but causing Republicans to ask the question, how much of this is cyclical? You know, related to Iraq, the economy, a really bad, you know, period. And how much of it is fundamental shifts among the public on social and moral issues and on the role of the government in the economy.
What's your take?
Well, my take is that you can't forget the fact that it was only 5 or 6 years ago that Republicans were dominant with pretty much this same electorate, and people were talking about the permanent Republican majority. So there is a cyclical aspect here. But there are disturbing signs, more fundamental signs as well, particularly how can you get Republicans elected in the Northeast, you know, and the coasts? How can you appeal to younger voters who seem deeply alienated from the Republican brand, don't see their concerns and views expressed? So, you know, the Republicans are going to have to be idea-oriented. They're going to have to be patient because Barack Obama will get his moment to succeed or fail. And they're going to have to bide their time. Right now, there's not much decisive they can do.
Margaret Taleb, is Arlen Specter one of a kind or not here? More defections in the wings?
I have to intercede first, just as a matter of course, to tell you that McClatchy Newspapers is doing just fine.
Just fine. Amen. And long may they remain. I'm just obsessed with the newspaper troubles
jokes
lately.
Today, please.
Sorry. Okay. You go.
We don't know yet. I think in his case, it was sort of a perfect storm. It was, he's 79 years old. Many people will be retired by now. If he wants to continue in the Senate, he had to do this. He had to do it. But
not win the primary as things are shaping up.
He absolutely GOP. Could not. And he wasn't ready to retire. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that much of a leap for him. So now to try to answer the broader question, certainly Democrats are trying, led by Vice President Joe Biden, who I don't know what he's saying to them, but he's telling them, don't take the subway. We need you in our party. Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins are sort of the most obvious targets for conversion. And
real targets? Really?
Well, in terms of Democrats trying to talk to them, yeah, yep. Sure. Mm-hmm. The day after Specter's decision was announced, we saw an op-ed piece in the New York Times by Senator Snowe, which at the very least provoked a lot of conversation about the timing of it. So I think the real answer is we don't know yet. Democrats would like to get as many conversions as they can, but it's all a question of the individual cases, the math, what years the races are, and whether it's a conversion that they could actually make in good conscience.
So, Jack, does it change the complexion of what you expect out of the next, three in some years or seven in some years, this one move? Does it sort of, in that back to the future way, does it change that photograph of the future?
I think it makes even less likely Republican votes for the Obama program because, after all, what does it say to the individual Republican member? Vote for something that Obama wants, and you get a primary opponent. You get someone from the right. And, one of the things that's happened in recent years is that the Republican, as with the Democratic incumbents, they're in districts that are really immune to cross-party challenges. Their worry is always the base, and Democrats have to get increasingly liberal, Republicans have to get increasingly conservative. And so what's in the interest of each individual Republican member, especially of the House, to be as anti-Obama as possible and to make no compromise at all, is not in the interest of their party. And that's a very dangerous cycle.
Let's go to Melanie in Middletown, Massachusetts. Melanie, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
The only comment I'd like to make about Arlen Specter's switch of parties is that I think he was driven out by his party. He was facing the extreme right wing of his party, and it makes it impossible for them to stay moderate. And I think that that's bad for the Republican Party.
And where do you fall? Democrat, independent, Republican? Where, Melanie?
I'm an independent who always votes Democrat.
But you're paying close attention, and it's hard to argue with there was a lot of driving out of town here. Speaking of driving, bankruptcy at Chrysler, Fiat coming in. Let's hear President Obama saying yesterday that Chrysler needed to go into bankruptcy and partner with the Italian Fiat.
Now, no one should be confused about what a bankruptcy process means. This is not a sign of weakness, but rather one more step on a clearly charted path to Chrysler's revival. Because of the fact that the UAW and many of the banks, the biggest stakeholders in this whole process, have already aligned, have already agreed, this process will be quick. It will be efficient. It's designed to deal with those last few holdups, and it will be controlled. It will not disrupt the lives of the people who work at Chrysler or live in communities that depend on it.
Well, let's hope that those are big promises. Let's get a view from Chicago. Chris, in Chicago, you're on the air. What do you think about the bankruptcy of the U.S. auto industry?
Well, hello. I grew up in the shadows of General Motors, and I do believe that Chrysler is working on a synergy with Fiat. I do believe that the shoe will drop when General Motors puts itself in the same process, and I really do anticipate that Chrysler will come out much better than General Motors could ever be, because General Motors has just constantly found itself coming from behind in the marketplace as well as their strategies.
Yeah, but Chrysler's always lived on the edge. I mean, even more than GM. You think they're better placed than GM to survive this because of Fiat, or why, Chris?
Well, I truly think it's just a size issue. I think it's the idea of turning around a smaller boat and being able to change course and adapt to the marketplaces and the changing world economy that we're in. And General Motors, I think it was the 17th floor that they used to talk about at General Motors. It still permeates through that corporation. They are very slow when it comes to adapting and making changes to meet the consumer demands and needs.
Yeah, well, they're being driven fast right now. But thanks for the perspective, Chris. Margaret Tolove, how do you look at this? Has this ended up engineered as the Obama administration wanted it? They had gigantic leverage here, but then the world is the world. Did they get the outcome they want, and can it really be sort of short, sharp, and overt, not disruptive, as the president says?
Oh, as they said yesterday, bankruptcy is never sort of, in theory, the ideal outcome, but I think they got the outcome that they had been preparing for weeks. From the get-go, we were initially talking about a controlled GM bankruptcy, but from those very early days, the White House press corps was asking, does this apply to Chrysler too? And they never ruled it out. They always knew it was a possibility that the hedge fund guys and the banks would balk. And you know, as the president sort of tipped his hand to the other night at his 100-day news conference, it is somewhat humbling, I think, when you're president and you realize you can't just make businesses do what you want. I mean, when you're holding billions of dollars sort of against them, you can leverage them, but you can't make them. And without the cooperation of those businesses, bankruptcy is the only alternative. Now, what I think is very interesting about what's going on with Chrysler is that part of the requirements that the federal government is able to sort of exercise is that Chrysler, the new Chrysler with Fiat, be compelled to make more fuel-efficient engines and a line of 40-mile-per-gallon cars. And the president is betting from a business sense that that will sell, and from a political sense that that's the right thing to do, and that that's the future. And I think that's a very interesting element of how he's tied his future to Chrysler's.
Michael Gerson, we're in new terrain here when the president is making business bets. On the other hand, your president, George W. Bush, didn't, and the companies ended up in a ditch, you know, pretty much on their own. Is this what you expected would happen as the outcome to George W. getting this started last fall with the first bailouts?
Well, I think you can make an argument that, you know, the political reality is that any president is eventually going to have to deal with this problem, just can't allow an uncontrolled bankruptcy in these cases. I think it's very difficult. I have to admit, I'm rooting for him, but I'm pretty skeptical in this case, basically because the main problem that both GM and Chrysler have faced is labor costs, which has caused them to produce kind of high-margin products like SUVs and vans and trucks. And instead of these, you know, the Toyota sort of market, and I'm not sure that this really solves that problem. I mean, you know, if you were designing a system, I'm not sure you'd give 55% control to the UAW, which is what's happened in this circumstance. You've given the federal government about 10% control, and you've given the rest of it to an automaker based in Turin, Italy. And I'm just not sure that's the right management team to do the changes that are necessary to make an effective company.
This is very new terrain. Yeah. Jack, I hear you there.
Well, moreover, you know, the smaller, more fuel-efficient car that the president wants Fiat slash Chrysler to produce, that car may not be sellable in the absence of public policy. It may become a victim to the fuel price cycle. We've seen that again and again. Just as soon as oil prices go below a certain level, people go for the bigger cars. And that's happened. It happened just recently this last year. And it may happen again in the absence of a floor, a substantial gasoline tax, carbon tax, that would prevent that cycle from essentially doing away with or undercutting the market for fuel-efficient cars.
Jack, I want to ask you right here. We're talking about the auto industry, but behind all this, the banking industry is still sitting there. And you've been thinking about that this week, I know. The banks, what's gone on so far under George W., under Obama, and Treasury Secretary Michael Gerson in particular. Michael Geithner, excuse me. You've been, I don't know, is that a promotion or a demotion? Jeez, okay, you know, all those G's. What do you say, Jeff?
Well, you know, this week, Gretchen Morgenson and Joe Becker in the New York Times wrote a 10,000-word article on Geithner that I think if it had appeared before he was confirmed, would have prevented him from being confirmed. This depicts him on Wall Street as a complete pet of the Wall Street forces he was and interests he was supposed to regulate and keep an eye on. Again and again and again, we have him meeting privately with no one else in the room, with high-flown people, with the likes of Sanford Weill, who offered the confector of Citigroup, who offers him the job of taking charge of it, meeting in restaurants where the Blue Plate special now is $69 for lunch, with people having dinner at their homes, all of this somewhat irregular. And again, when any kind of time a decision comes up, this man says, oh, we have to go easier on the banks. We can't make them have reserves of you know, currency reserves so they'll be able to pay off their debts. Oh, we can't have too much regulation over here. This fellow is a creature of Wall Street. And it isn't just the past. And this article just goes through chapter and verse. It's now. The bill that he sent to Congress, or the information on the bill he sent to Congress to allow, to give the Treasury the opportunity to intervene in cases like AIG, these too big to fail entities, was actually printed on stationery or computer paper from a Wall Street law firm. He just took what the law firm gave him and plastered it in the bill and sent it to the Congress. The president has made a grave mistake in appointing this man. He wants now to funnel potentially $1 trillion into propping up these banks. And he is in so many ways their complete pet and creature. And it's made me lose complete confidence in Mr. Obama's economic judgment that he could put this man with these policies at this time in charge of the Treasury.
Boy, I guess we know what you really think. But now he's in charge of a lot of the economy. Said this week he doesn't want to be, but there it is. Margaret Tolliff, do you hear echoes of Jack's complaint, concern among Democrats in Washington? Do you hear the White House itself thinking, why did we pick this Gerson guy? Forgive me, Mike.
I wish I had $1 trillion to give away.
Remember me. What do you say, Margaret?
Not from the center, not with the same volume that Jack's expressing it. I think there are some concerns, but that most... Can I say this? Most members of Congress don't have enough self-confidence that they understand the sort of macro capitalist economics that drive the nation and the world to second guess him. They're more content to sort of, you know, criticize him from a couple steps back. I think there's a lot of residual frustration over his tax problems in the beginning, over his sort of poor bedside manner when it comes to talking, both with officials and with the public about it. And I honestly think that as much as his ties to Wall Street and his proposed fixes are driving a lot of the dissatisfaction with him.
And I would add that this is a fairly traditional Democratic maneuver for new administrations. I mean, Bill Clinton had Robert Rubin, who reassured Wall Street. You know, John Kennedy did the same thing. You know, Democrats don't want to come in and seem like they're wild-eyed socialist levelers, okay? And I think, he served that purpose. The question here is, people are so desperate to solve this problem, okay, the banking problem, the credit problem, that they're willing to turn to someone they think is an insider that knows, what he's talking about.
That's right.
The real question here is whether that's, whether these are inside deals that he's essentially proposing, which there are elements of that in this plan of, four or five big firms that are going to, take a lot of this this money, on behalf of a lot of other investors in the way that he proposes it. And I think there will be some backlash against this. This is a kind of a, inside play, which we all hope works, but I think there are questions.
But don't we have to wait, Margaret, on final judgment until we see the stress test stuff come out and the new regulations come out? Won't that tell a lot as well?
Yeah, absolutely. There are several tests ahead, and one is the stress test on banks. Two is just time. I mean, if I can play devil's advocate for a second, and I'm not here to be Tim Geithner's champion, but things haven't turned around. It's not like I wouldn't use the light at the end of the tunnel thing yet, but it's not like the bottom's completely fallen out either. I mean, stuff has been, to some extent, contained, and nobody, most people, were not predicting anything like an immediate turnaround as a resolution to these proposals that are being put in place. It's very expensive. It's very frustrating. It's very frustrating to watch the guys who, you know, sort of engineered this now profit from the back end of it. But I don't think anyone's really ready to say yet that it's been a failure. And so you have to withhold judgment.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Pandemic fever and flu shots this week, a basketball barn burner, and panic underwing in lower Manhattan, swine flu humor. Jay Leno apologized for being out sick. His explanation?
I think this was a mistake. You know, I ate a raw pig a friend brought back from Mexico.
The Chicago Bulls and Boston Celtics go to a record 7 playoff overtimes in their best of 7 series. Last night alone, 3, and the Bulls pulled it out.
Rajon Rondo gets the ball, misses the game-winning half-court heave.
It's good!
And Chicago goes on to win it 128-127. This is one of the most exciting series in the history of the NBA.
And no, Rondo shot was not good. Game 7 Saturday night, and an Air Force One photo op over Manhattan sent New Yorkers screaming and let every newscaster in America say the word, stupid.
Run, run!
That was hard to watch, and who can blame them for being scared as that big 747 with the jet fighters alongside flew over lower Manhattan. Holy smokes. My turn. Stupid. Michael Gerson is with us, columnist for The Washington Post. Margaret Tolliv is here, White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to Joe in Millbury, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, and a happy May Day to all of you.
Happy May Day to you, sir.
I just want to back up Joe Biden. If people had watched the complete question to him and his answer, he was doing what he does first. He is first and foremost a doctor. And he
Joe Biden is? Dr. Joe?
I'm sorry, I've got the wrong person. I thought he... There's another senator who was a doctor. And I
well, he's
I
first and foremost vice president at this point, but you're sticking up for him saying he... What? That's what you would tell your kids too?
If somebody is still on an airplane, which is an enclosed space, which recycles the air from where they take off until when they land, you are going to be breathing in those molecules, and it goes from there. He was just saying he was concerned for his family and anybody who will be doing this. He's.
Yeah, okay, well, we got it. Okay, I mean, maybe I'm having too much fun with snakes on a plane. I take your point. I'm not eager to get on a plane right now, but I guess if I had to, I would. And you're right. I mean, the vice president began to play doctor there, maybe a little bit out of his league on the medical front, but honest advice. Let's get a call from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Kenny, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly. What do you see?
Just a comment about Arlen Specter and this whole controversy with him and switching parties. I work in a hospital, and I just make a correlation here. When people have made the decision, the end-of-life decision, to not do any heroic measures, what we call a DNR in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
It's always funny at the end, some people choose to change their wishes from before when they become what they call air hungry, and then they're asked again, do you want to be put on a ventilator and kept alive?
Mm-hmm.
Many people choose to do that route. And I look at Arlen Specter, and I see the same thing. He saw death in front of him in the Republican Party, his political career, and he chose to be put on an air hose. Unfortunate, but good for the Republican Party. Good riddance. Goodbye, Mr. Specter.
We got it. Air hungry as his party slipped away from him, or now he slips away from it. Thanks very much. And let's get one from Michael in Needham, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
So the top story for me as a former owner of a Fiat back in the 70s was the Chrysler-Fiat deal. The elephant in the room here for me really was witnessed back out in Shanghai at the auto show that was held there fairly recently.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago.
The Chinese auto industry is producing increasingly high-quality cars designed not just for the very large Chinese market, but clearly aimed for the North American market. If the U.S. auto industry disappears, it's going to be replaced by the Chinese auto industry. And I think it's really important to keep a domestic auto industry viable in order to compete with the forthcoming Chinese cars.
And you drove that Fiat. Now that we've got bankruptcy plus Fiat plus Chrysler, do you see that as a recipe for survival?
Fiat has made a remarkable recovery over the years and made significant improvements in the quality of its cars. And with its ownership of both Ferrari and Alfa, I look forward to driving cars with the Fiat brand.
And let's get one more. Thank you, Michael. And let's get one more before we go to Justice Souter, Washington, Iowa. Bob. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'm a pork producer, and I know it seems mundane or humorous to a lot of people, but I wanted to give a little bit of perspective from people that are in an industry. We've already been hammered by ethanol prices eating into our feed prices. We're losing money. The president and national media have been asked not to call it swine flu. I'll tell you what it's like. My hog buyer told me that some of the buyers for major grocery chains aren't even buying. They aren't even bidding on some meat because there's such hysteria over this. As far as I know, you referred a little bit earlier to it may have come from hogs. I know of no evidence that there are any cases with hogs, and it has no association with hogs.
Well, every TV crew that I've seen fly down to this little town or village in rural Mexico, you know, takes their cameras out to the Smithfield hog factory farm on the edge of town and says, here's where local suspicions lie. You think that's hogwash, Bob?
Oh, if there were hogs there with flu, then they could tell you there are hogs here with flu. There are no hogs there with flu. There are no hogs in America with flu. It's part of the classification. It's avian, it's swine, and it's human. It's just another case of flu. As far as I know, the mortality rates are no higher than regular flu. Maybe you know differently. I don't think that's true, though.
Well, listen, we're going to N1H1. It's more complicated. It's not just hogs, and I hear you loud and clear. Hey, I was one of those kids at the county fair putting the Eat More Pork bumper stickers on the back of everybody's cars and getting chased off. I like a good pork chop, but we hear you, Bob. Thank you very much for calling. I want to hear from the man who will leave the Supreme Court this summer, Justice David Souter. George Bush the First put him in, disappointed conservatives for not helping overturn Roe v. Wade, among other things. He's not talking about this publicly yet. His friends and those who know him are saying he will go at the end of this term in June. Just to hear him, here he is during oral arguments in 2003 in one of the first cases about detainees in the war on terror. You hear his moderate position being staked out.
The fact is, I will assume that on September 12th, without any authorization from Congress at all, the president could have taken action in relation to this individual, I mean, if he had been fighting on a battlefield, that the president took. But it doesn't follow that the president's authority to do that is indefinite for all time.
The moderate voice of the Republican-appointed Justice David Souter. Margaret Tolliff, what do you make of his heading off to New Hampshire, and what do people see coming in behind?
I think it's very interesting news, and coming the same week as Specter's party switch, it sort of helps you to understand, to some extent, why the controlling party in Congress, as well as the political persuasion of the president, matters. These are lifetime appointments, or at least for as long as you want them. I think the sort of conventional wisdom, and I think this is right, is that Souter's departure is not going to make an immediate difference in terms of the balance of the court, because he is, although he was tapped by a Republican, practiced his job as more of a moderate to liberal. And so the expectation is that President Obama will fill the position with probably a somewhat similar sensibility. No litmus tests, we know, but I mean, come on. And but I think this is sort of a test case for the perhaps some of the vacancies down the line during Obama's administration that really matter. We'll get a sense of what the president looks for in his nominees and how the remaining Republican opposition in the Senate responds.
Justice Ginsburg has not been well. Sandra Day O'Connor is off the court. Do you presume he will look for a woman?
I don't presume, but if I were a betting person and I were going to place a bet, I'd probably place it on a woman, knowing that I could be wrong and lose because Obama's not always predictable. But yeah, I think it's more likely than not that it would be a woman. It may be a woman of color or a minority woman as well.
Michael Gerson, what do you make? What's the moral of the Justice Souter story?
Well, the biggest moral of the Justice Souter story is that a president of the United States probably shouldn't pick someone with a very limited record, because you have no idea what they're going to do with a lifetime appointment. This was George H.W. Bush's, attempt to smuggle someone through the process with very little record, and it backfired from his perspective in a major way. And I don't think that Obama is even going to attempt that strategy. He has much stronger support in the Congress. I think it's unfair to call him Souter a moderate. On the most controversial social issues that people are concerned about, he was a reliable liberal vote. But the reality is that he wasn't an intellectual leader for those issues on the court. And so there could be a shift here if Obama picks someone that becomes an intellectual leader of the left on the court, that it could help shift the court at least marginally in a certain direction.
Jack, how do you see it?
Well, my recollection of David Souter is his face when he, as his car emerged from the Supreme Court garage the day the court handed down its decision in Bush v. Gore. He was preceded by Justice Breyer, who had his son with him in the front seat. But Souter was all alone, and I've rarely seen a face. Perhaps I was projecting my own dismay, but I've rarely seen a face of a public official so ravaged. Now I read from Jeffrey Toobin that, in fact, Bush v. Gore was a agonizing moment for him because it made him think that this branch of government that he saw as independent was compromised, was politically compromised, and that this decision was simply a political decision. And that it called into question his relationship with others on the court and his whole belief in the court.
Margaret, he's only 69 years old, said to be longing to get back to New Hampshire and get the heck out of Washington. Do you look at it as does he just not like the waters there, or is it the legacy of these decisions, moments like the one Jack describes?
Because he's such a private man, I think that's something where it's hard for me to presume. One theory is that he wants to get out of the way now because there may be a time when President Obama has one or two vacancies simultaneously in his presidency and he doesn't want to make it two or three vacancies. Or he may just be sick of it. It's probably maybe a little bit of both. But I think there's some strategy to the timing is my guess.
Let's go to Mark in Dillon, South Carolina. Mark, you are on the air.
Yeah, sir. I'd like to see President Obama nominate his former pastor Jeremiah Wright, to kind of equalize out the other justices, and I'm sure the Democratic Party would love to have him there.
Now, Mark, are you funning with us, sir?
No, sir. I'm dead on the money with you.
Justice Jeremiah Wright.
That's our president's pastor.
Well, he was, and we know he's comfortable in a robe.
That's exactly right. He is. Right. I think he would level things up.
I don't know. I think he's more likely to meet up with David Souter fishing in New Hampshire than end up on the Supreme Court. But let's see. Thank you for your call, Mark. Malcolm in New Haven, Connecticut. Malcolm, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling regarding getting your opinion on from your guest regarding Senator Durbin's amendment to the mortgage, I'm going to call it Reformation, though I'm not sure the name, that was shot down yesterday, and the impact that will have, in my impression, immediate impact on increase in foreclosures throughout the United States.
Let us pick up on that. Jack, I hear you there.
Oh, yes, this was a disgrace. Dick Durbin said banks own the United States Senate. This after the corruption, after the collapse of the economy, after the reckless run of greed that has brought us to this pass. Banks still own the Senate. Politico reported the primary reason for the bank's success is simple: money. The industry spent $56 million lobbying Congress last year alone. That buys a lot of friends. And just in the last couple of months, between January and March, 800,000 people have received foreclosure-related notices. And now the Senate is essentially saying, sorry, courts can't adjudicate these foreclosure rulings because the banks have signed a contract with these people. I mean, it is a victory for the very forces that have driven this economy into the ditch, and it is an example of the flagrant ownership of Congress in our investor-driven politics.
Jack, your pitchfork is shining six ways to Sunday today.
You're on fire.
Wow. The problem here on this is, Jack's exactly right that there is a lot of responsibility and liability on the part of the banking industry and all this. The difficulty, the paradox of the situation is they have to be healthy or the American economy isn't healthy. If you demonize them too much, if you undermine their ability to make a profit and return to lending, then you're in a situation where you can't get out of the fix we're in. I mean, the banking and credit system is the absolute prerequisite for economic recovery. It's the reason it's the first on the list. This isn't a matter of guilt or innocence. It's a matter, in many ways, of a working industry or a not working industry. Now, I don't know about this particular amendment, but the fact of the matter is we need the banking industry to be healthy and lending money to people. And, I think that that's Geithner's focus. I think that's the president's focus. It's not just being owned by this industry. It's not. It's also that America depends on it.
We're not going to solve that one this week, but it's right out there. Got to have this moment from the 100 days. Is Hubba Hubba this week. New York Times, Jeff Zeleny at the president's press conference with this multi-part question.
During these first 100 days, what has surprised you the most about this office, enchanted you the most about serving in this office, humbled you the most, and troubled you the most?
Let me write this down.
Surprised. Right, troubled.
I've got, what was the first one?
Surprised. Troubled.
Troubled.
Enchanted.
Enchanted, nice.
And humbled.
And what was the last one? Humbled?
Humbled. Thank you, sir.
All right.
I expected Lena Horne in there with Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered. Margaret Tolliver, how do you think the president handled his 100-day, moment here? We just got half a minute, Margaret.
I think he did very well in that news conference, but I think some of the things that are lingering, the questions that came back to him that he just wishes would go away, darn it, haven't gone away, and he can't handle them with a clever answer. Handling of detainees going forward, interrogation practices, executive power, and on and on and on. And those aren't as easy to answer with a quip.
They are not going away easily, maybe not at all, and we will face them square on. Margaret Tolliver with McClatchy Newspapers, the proud and healthy McClatchy Newspapers. Margaret, thank you very much for being with us today.
Always my pleasure. Thanks.
Michael Gerson, the Council on Foreign Relations columnist for The Washington Post, speechwriter and policy advisor to President George W. Bush, author of Heroic Conservatism. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you.
And Jack, you can simmer down now with David Souter up maybe up there this week. Thanks a lot. Have a good one. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.